Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire.
Welcome to Radio Sci-Fi, your podcast for science fiction old-time radio. You're cleared for takeoff. Hello, this is Clyde J. Gale with a brief reminder. Mystery Play Internet Radio is listener-supported, so I encourage your monetary support with a donation today. Please visit www.mpir-otr.com and click on the donations page. A one-time donation of any amount will be greatly appreciated. Again, that's www.mpir-otr.com. And thank you for listening to Mystery Play Internet Radio.
The thing from another world. How did it get here? Where did it come from? What is it? Is it human or inhuman? Earthly or unearthly? Baffling questions, astounding questions that not even the world's greatest scientific minds can answer.
Fellas, here's your story. North Pole, November 3rd. Ned Scott reporting. One of the world's greatest battles was fought and won today by the human race. Here at the top of the world, a handful of American soldiers and civilians met the first invasion from another planet. And now, before giving you the details of the battle, I bring you a warning. Every one of you listening to my voice, tell the world, tell this to everybody wherever they are. Watch the skies everywhere. Keep looking. Keep watching the skies.
Well, who can argue with that? Hello, I'm Joanna Lumley, and as watching the skies is a little difficult to do on radio, why don't we listen to them instead? For the next hour, we're going to spend our time in the company of aliens, monsters, and scientists for a celebration of science fiction films from the 1950s. I wonder how many of you can remember the 50s. The decade that introduced us to rock and roll and commercial television, when there was no such thing as Doctor Who or Star Trek, and a visit to the cinema cost as little as 1 shilling and 10 pence. How much? Yet it was still the best value for money, with not one, but two feature films, a newsreel, and previews of coming attractions. Previews like the one we heard at the beginning of the program. For this was the decade of the science fiction blockbuster. Films which brought to life, through spectacular special effects, all manner of bug-eyed monsters, extraterrestrials, other planets, and flying saucers. Flying saucers like the one responsible for our first alien visitor, the Thing from Another World. The only witnesses to the alien spacecraft that crashes in the frozen wastes of the Arctic Circle are a group of American scientists and military officials. Their efforts to uncover the saucer end in disaster, and all seems lost, until something else is discovered buried in the ice.
What is it?
Looks like a man.
Yeah, it's got legs and a head. I can see him.
Yeah, he must be over 8 feet long.
Somebody got out of that saucer?
Got out or was thrown out, then frozen fast before he could get clear.
Man from Mars.
How do you propose getting him out? Here's some axes you can chop around to put the whole block in the sled and take it to the plane. I agree
get
with that.
Get started. You'll be real Bob. Clear the sled off and bring it over here. Eddie, get the ship warmed up. Be ready to get out of here in a hurry.
The block of ice takes some time to melt. And when it does, the scientist's home, a small military outpost cut off from civilization by a fierce snowstorm, is menaced by one of the most ferocious of alien invaders. A creature, the scientists realize, that is far from human.
Look here. I took this from under the soft tissue on the palm of the hand.
Seed pod. What? Seed pod?
Yes. The neat and unconfused reproductive technique of vegetation. Gentlemen, do you realize what we've found? A being from another world, as different from us as one pole from the other. If we can only communicate with it.
Ah, if only they could. Unfortunately, this inhuman alien, referred to by one character in the film as a form of intelligent carrot, proves impervious to both fire and extreme cold. Only a charge of high voltage succeeds in destroying the monster once and for all. Hidden beneath the thing's grotesque makeup was actor James Arness, who, you may recall, played Marshal Matt Dillon in Gunsmoke. The film was produced by Howard Hawks, better known for his adult comedies. Along with director Christian Nyby, Hawks evoked in The Thing an atmosphere of sheer terror. There's even some controversy over who actually directed certain scenes. Studio sources have hinted at Hawks himself, and more fanciful claims have cited Orson Welles as being responsible. In the end, it didn't really matter, for the film was an enormous success, and its bleak warning to keep watching the skies didn't go unheeded. Everywhere, filmmakers were scouring the heavens for more sightings of unidentified flying objects.
Reports are coming in from all over the empire, from all over the world. The government has not yet issued any statement, but there seems to be no question that there actually is a large unidentified object circling the Earth at incredible speed.
This is Elmer Davis again. We still don't know what it is or where it comes from, but there's something there. It's been tracked around the Earth by radar, traveling at a rate of 4,000 miles an hour.
This is not another flying saucer scare. Scientists and military men are already agreed on that. Whatever it is, it's something real.
It's something real, all right. And not surprisingly, as this is a Hollywood film, it lands in Washington, D.C. The Day the Earth Stood Still starred Michael Rennie as Klaatu, a suave alien emissary who visits the Earth with a message of the utmost importance.
Have you been traveling long?
About 5 months. Your months.
You must have come a long way.
About 250 million of your miles. I want to meet with representatives from all the nations of the Earth.
I want to be frank with you, Mr. I mean, Klaatu. Our world at the moment is full of tensions and suspicions. In the present international situation, such a meeting would be quite impossible.
My mission here is not to solve your petty squabbles. It concerns the existence of every last creature on Earth.
Perhaps if you could explain a little.
I intend to explain. To all the nations. At the same time. How do we proceed, Mr. Harley?
Klaatu, proving that even visitors from space have a hard time when dealing with politicians. But Klaatu hasn't traveled 250 million miles alone. For protection, he's brought with him a giant, indestructible robot called Gort. Benevolent and less provoked, Gort has terrifying powers.
Worried about Gort. I'm afraid of what he might do if anything should happen to me.
Gort, but he's a robot. Without you, what could he do?
There's no limit to what he could do. He could destroy the Earth. If anything should happen to me, you must go to Gort. You must say these words. Klaatu, Barada, Nikto. Please repeat that.
Klaatu, Barada, Nikto.
You must remember those words.
Klaatu, Barada, Nikto. One of the most famous lines in science fiction cinema, and the only way that Michael Rennie's co-star, Patricia Neal, can hope to stop Gort from destroying mankind. Finding an actor tall enough to portray the giant robot proved a major problem for director Robert Wise. After contacting numerous casting agencies, Wise finally employed the services of Locke Martin, the 7'7" doorman of Hollywood's famous Grauman's Chinese Theatre. But Martin still found the work grueling, having to stand motionless for hours at a time during rehearsals. To make his job easier, the robot suit was made of rubber. Klaatu's flying saucer, on the other hand, was made of wood and painted silver. Costing $100,000 to build, this giant prop had to be specially weighted in order to prevent it from being blown away by high winds. As the authorities' mistrust of Klaatu grows to a nationwide panic, the alien, frustrated at the short-sightedness of the politicians, delivers his vitally important message to a group of international scientists who have gathered outside his spaceship.
I am leaving soon, and you will forgive me if I speak bluntly. The universe grows smaller every day, and the threat of aggression by any group, anywhere, can no longer be tolerated. Your ancestors knew this when they made laws to govern themselves and hired policemen to enforce them. For our policemen, we created a race of robots. In matters of aggression, we have given them absolute power over us. This power cannot be revoked. At the first sign of violence, they act automatically against the aggressor. The penalty for provoking their action is too terrible to risk. It is no concern of ours how you run your own planet. But if you threaten to extend your violence, this Earth of yours will be reduced to a burned-out cinder. Your choice is simple. Join us and live in peace, or pursue your present course and face obliteration. We shall be waiting for your answer. The decision rests with you.
We may have misunderstood Klaatu, but at least he came to visit us in peace. In science fiction films, this wasn't always the case, as we shall see later. But even the terror of the Thing pales in comparison with the diabolical intentions of our next wave of extraterrestrials. But first, a history lesson.
From the First World War and for the first time in the history of man, nations combined to fight against nations using the crude weapons of those days. The Second World War involved every continent on the globe, and men turned to science for new devices of warfare, which reached an unparalleled peak in their capacity for destruction. And now, fought with the terrible weapons of super science, menacing all mankind and every creature on Earth, comes the War of the World.
Paul Frees' opening narration for the 1953 film adaptation of H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds. Originally bought by Paramount Pictures for director Cecil B. DeMille, the script gathered dust in the studio vaults before being considered as a possible film treatment by, among others, the great Russian director Sergei Eisenstein and the master of suspense himself, Alfred Hitchcock. It finally fell to Hungarian filmmaker George Pal to transfer Wells' idea to the screen. We'll hear more about Pal's work later in the program, but it's The War of the Worlds for which he's best remembered. At a cost of $2 million, Pal updated Wells' apocalyptic invasion of Earth and moved it from southern England to California. After crash landing in a spaceship disguised as a meteor, the Martian war machines, resembling flying manta rays with cobra-shaped appendages, emerge from their mothership for a fiery confrontation with the Earth's military defenses. But not before a local priest attempts to communicate with them.
Who's that? What's he think he's doing?
Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil.
It's seen him.
Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup runneth over. And I will dwell in the house of the Lord.
The war has begun. Having replaced the Martian tripod machines, depicted so vividly in Wells' original story, with a type of flying saucer supported on transparent rays, the Paramount Effects Department built three highly detailed miniatures, 3.5 feet across, and suspended them from the roof of the soundstage with 15 fine piano wires. One critic was prompted to describe the whole affair as puppetry on a vast scale. But it was the machine's sinister appearance and deadly weaponry that caught the public's attention. The man responsible for the design of the Martian was Al Mazzacchi.
I would say the idea came almost to full bloom. The concept here is almost identical with the original. And I was noodling one Sunday afternoon on a sketch pad, and the idea of this machine came like the light bulbs in the comic section. One of the requirements, of course, of this machine was it had the menacing appearance. The manta ray concept did help some in that regard. Byron Haskin and Gordon Jennings, they both liked it immediately, and Hal particularly, I think because it helped his concept of what this machine should do in the picture.
To enhance the technical superiority of the machines in the story, the special effects department designed an impenetrable force field to protect them from man-made weapons, including the atom bomb. Retaliating with their destructive rays, the Martians slash across country like scythes, wiping out everything that stands in their way.
Guns, tanks, bombs, they're like toys against them.
It'll end only one way. We're beaten. No. Not yet. Our best hope lies in what you people can develop to help us.
We'll take all our instruments and establish a base laboratory in the Rocky Mountains. It'll give us time to search out some weakness in the Martians.
You mean by some biological approach?
We know now that we can't beat their machines. We've got to beat them.
Gene Barry suggesting that biological warfare may be man's only hope against the seemingly invincible Martians. But before he and his colleagues have time to act, the invaders' mighty armada succumbs to earthly bacteria, their final demise being just as H.G. Wells had envisaged it, although the author may have objected to the overly religious ending, narrated in reverential tone by veteran actor Sir Cedric Hardwick.
The Martians had no resistance to the bacteria in our atmosphere to which we have long since become immune. Once they had breathed our air, germs which no longer affect us began to kill them. The end came swiftly. All over the world, their machines began to stop and fall. After all that men could do had failed, the Martians were destroyed and humanity was saved by the littlest things which God in his wisdom had put upon this earth.
The War of the Worlds' nightmarish view of Armageddon won the 1953 Oscar for special effects and an X-rated certificate in British cinemas. Some critics interpreted the film as an anti-communist allegory, substituting Martians for Russians. Hollywood, however, preferred to market the film as just spectacular entertainment. The success of the War of the Worlds inspired other invasions of Earth that were highly imaginative in their own right. First, there was Kronos, the name given to a giant robot that's sent to drain the Earth of energy. As this unstoppable alien mechanism marched across the landscape in search of power, the cast, led by Jeff Morrow, acted out their meager parts in sets left over from the day the Earth stood still. Kronos finally ate one electron too many and blew himself up, a fate that also befell invaders from Mars. Slaves of a disembodied head in a glass ball, the Martians bury themselves in a sandpit before waging war on the Earth. Turning people into mindless killers, these residents of the Red Planet are finally defeated through the bravery of a small boy, a local astronomer, and, that good old standby of films of this nature, the United States Army. Invaders from Mars was produced by William Cameron Menzies, who directed H.G. Wells' Things to Come, and designed the sets for Gone with the Wind. Earth versus the Flying Saucers, on the other hand, relied on a plot similar to the War of the Worlds. Using stock footage, a technical term to describe scenes borrowed from bigger budgeted films, the flying saucers of the title and their weird robot occupants leveled Washington, D.C., courtesy of special effects ace Ray Harryhausen. But unlike the aliens in the War of the Worlds and some of its low-budget imitators, not all our visitors came in spaceships.
From time immemorial, the Earth has been bombarded by objects from outer space. Bits and pieces of the universe piercing our atmosphere in an invasion that never ends. But from time to time, from the beginning of time, a very few meteors have struck the crust of the Earth and formed craters. Craters of all sizes, sought after and pored over by scientists of all nations for the priceless knowledge buried within them.
The meteor that crashes outside the small Midwest town of San Angelo, California, does contain, as our narrator Paul Frees suspects, a secret of truly gigantic proportions in The Monolith Monsters. A fitting title, you might think, when I tell you that the film's main protagonists are towering columns of rock. Skyscraper-high structures that grow quicker than the legendary beanstalk before splintering into a thousand deadly pieces. With the town right in their path, there's only one course of action.
Evacuate? The entire town? Chief, those rocks are going to come crashing through here like an avalanche over an anthill. There won't be a living thing left. You won't even be able to tell where San Angelo was.
When they're no longer confined within the walls of the canyon, when they break out onto the open valley floor, their rate of multiplication is going to be frightening.
You mean they'll grow even faster? Each one that shatters will make 100 more.
When that 100 shatters, there'll be 10,000 of them. The third cycle will create 1,000,000. Unless we can stop them, they'll spread over the whole countryside.
Grant Williams and Trevor Bardet on the problems of dealing with meteors. Reacting with moisture in the desert soil, nothing, it seems, can stop the monoliths. And to make matters worse, human contact with these marauding pillars of rock turns people to stone. Made on a minuscule budget, the film's special effects are very convincing. But the story is most effective in its depiction of man struggling to survive amid the trackless wilderness of the American desert. Based on a short story by filmmaker Jack Arnold, The Monolith Monsters is just one example of a number of science fiction films set in what critics came to refer to later as an alien Earth environment. In fact, it's the most significant feature of Arnold's best-remembered film, It Came from Outer Space. Here, the inhospitable desert provides a safe haven for one-eyed, blob-like creatures. Set in a small Californian town, amateur astronomer John Putnam, played by Richard Carlson, witnesses the arrival of what he at first believes is a giant meteorite. When he discovers that the visitor is, in fact, an alien spaceship, nobody believes him. When a number of the townspeople start behaving strangely, Putnam suspects the aliens.
What do you want?
We have souls and minds, and we are good.
Then why are you hiding?
We are not yet ready to meet in friendship.
Why not?
Because you would be horrified at the sight of us. Keep your people away, or we will destroy them.
How do I know that your whole mission here isn't to destroy all of us?
Our mission was to another world. You must believe me. Only an error dragged us toward Earth. Let us stay apart, the people of your world and ours. For if we come together, there will only be destruction.
Disaster is avoided when, with their spaceship repaired, the aliens make a hasty departure. Filmed in 3D, the glaring eye of the Cyclopean invader loomed out at the audience, thanks to a process that worked extremely well in fantasy films. But a more sinister aspect of It Came from Outer Space actually concerned the threat of possession, the possibility that friends and relatives could so easily be brainwashed by aliens, or worse, completely absorbed, an even more insidious fate that awaited the innocent victims of the invasion of the body snatchers.
They're like huge sea pods.
Miles, where do they come from?
I don't know. If they are seeds or seed pods, they must grow someplace on a plant, probably. And somebody or something wants this duplication to take place.
But when they're finished, what happens to our bodies?
I don't know. When the process is completed, probably the original is destroyed or disintegrates.
No, wait!
Right, but I take a dim view of watching my own destruction take place.
There isn't any danger until they're completely formed. We learned that last night at your house. Your blank didn't change right away.
Not until you fell asleep. They have to be destroyed. All of them.
They will be. Every one of them.
Dr. Miles Bennell, played by Kevin McCarthy, his girlfriend Becky, Dana Winter, and friends discovering something nasty in the greenhouse. They've every reason to be scared, for the townspeople, who've already become pods, will stop at nothing to expedite the alien invasion of Earth.
Miles, you and I are scientific men. You can understand the wonder of what's happened. Now just think. Less than a month ago, Santa Mara was like any other town. People with nothing but problems. Then out of the sky came a solution. Seeds drifting through space for years took root in a farmer's field. From the seeds came pods, which have the power to reproduce themselves in the exact likeness of any form of life. Suddenly, while you're asleep, they'll absorb your minds, your memories, and you're reborn into an untroubled world.
where everyone's the same?
Exactly. What a world.
What a world indeed. Directed by Don Siegel, whose credits include Clint Eastwood's thriller Dirty Harry, and with script rewrites by none other than Sam Peckinpah, Invasion of the Body Snatchers is now considered a masterpiece. Shot in just 19 days, with minimal special effects, the story is set in the small Californian town of Santa Mira, although the film was made on location around Los Angeles. What makes Invasion of the Body Snatchers as popular today as it was in 1956 is the idea that science fiction could have political interpretations. At the time of its release, the whole world was in a Cold War. The possibility that the United States might be overrun by sinister communist forces was unthinkable. Even Hollywood sacked numerous writers and directors, believing them to be communist sympathizers. The fear of political oppression manifested itself as a distinct and national paranoia. The audiences who saw Invasion of the Body Snatchers made an immediate comparison between communism and pod people, and shared every moment of Dr. Bennell's terror.
I ran. My only hope was to get away from Santa Mira, to get to the highway, to warn the others of what was happening.
Hey! Hey, stop! Pull up, will you? Pull over to the side of the road. I need your help. Something terrible has happened.
Go on, you drunk. Get out of the street. Get out of here. Go on.
Kevin McCarthy trying unsuccessfully to warn his fellow human beings of the approaching danger. Siegel wanted to end the film on this somber note, but the studio, Allied Artists, insisted it was too downbeat and that an epilogue should be added in which the authorities are finally convinced of the invasion of the pods. And it's the pods, or something very similar, and their final objective, the destruction of men's minds, that's the subject of our next film. Professor Quatermass, the head of an experimental rocket group, is disappointed when his moon project is rejected by the British government. The reason? They've already built the facility, complete with giant atmosphere domes in the middle of the English countryside. To be precise, Winnerton Flats, a cold and desolate peninsula in northeast England. Here, in this windswept corner of the country, strange meteorites are falling to Earth, the vanguard of an invasion that threatens the whole world.
Try and imagine an organism to which oxygen is not an essential of life, but a destroyer. An organism which is unable to exist in our atmosphere for more than 3 or 4 seconds, safe only in a shell, sealed in with a mixture of gases, methane, maybe even hydrogen.
And when it breaks out?
It dies. Unless its energy is expended on an object that can exist in our atmosphere. A human target? An immediate invasion of his entire nervous system. Something is implanted, an instinct, a blind compulsion to act for them.
Brian Don Levy as Professor Quatermass, outlining the facts of the case to newspaper reporter Sid James. With growing numbers of humans possessed by the alien parasites, the professor breaks into the plant and is shocked by what he finds.
Inside those domes are creatures from outside this earth.
Ah, you're mad.
I've seen them. Thousands of tiny creatures that can join together and expand into things 100 feet high. And each one can infect a human being.
Like the dead Sheila.
Yes, and those wretched creatures you call zombies. Take a look at them, you'll find the mark.
The mark was a sort of V-shaped tissue scar, and the only way to detect an alien host. At the film's climax, the domes are destroyed, and the giant creatures, looking suspiciously like huge woolen socks, are finally poisoned by our oxygen-rich atmosphere. Based on Nigel Neill's highly successful BBC television series, Quatermass 2 was the second film in a trilogy that succeeded in terrifying its audience. It was released in 1957, at a time when a number of strange government facilities and industrial complexes began appearing up and down the country. These included top-secret research labs, atomic power stations, early warning missile sites, and the location chosen by Hammer Films for Quatermass 2, the Shoalhaven oil refinery in Essex. The miles of steel ducts and pipes, eerily photographed in black and white, added greatly to the overall atmosphere. Together with James Bernard's doom-laden score, Quatermass 2 became one of the great science fiction films of all time. Also based on a British television serial was The Trollenberg Terror. Set amid the majestic splendor of the Swiss Alps, the story begins with a number of fatal climbing accidents. Only the bravest, or, according to the villagers, the most foolhardy, will attempt to scale the Trollenberg, for there have been reports of strange clouds and freezing temperatures.
Hey, Jimmy! Hang on a minute. Can't see. Foggy. Hey, wait a minute. Someone coming.
Who is it, Jim? The abominable snowman?
I tell you, there's someone coming. I can't see a thing. Who is it?
No! No! No!
Still there? Good. I'm afraid things are going to get a lot worse before the film's frightening climax. And the reason? Well, hideous octopus-like creatures have invaded the Earth. Their evil plans are detected by mind reader Anne Pilgrim, played by Janet Monroe, who visits Trollenberg while en route for Geneva. In a particularly hair-raising sequence, the aliens, who are determined to keep their invasion plans a secret, resurrect a dead climber from a previous expedition and send him to kill her. Fortunately, the attempt fails. But just what are the aliens up to?
There are many galaxies besides ours. Now, who knows what is happening millions of miles out in space? Perhaps the world that these creatures inhabit is coming to an end. Perhaps they need to find somewhere else to live.
Well, why pick on us?
We don't know. It's just us. Maybe it's also on Mars, Venus, Jupiter. Who can tell?
Why, do you think, do they always happen to land on the tops of mountains? First the Andes and now the Trollenberg.
Well, it's the atmosphere, I think. You see, it gets much thinner high up. Well, perhaps these creatures need that. The clouds would seem to indicate this too, creating their own atmosphere.
Well, if they can only exist on the tops of mountains, they're hardly likely to inherit the Earth, are they?
You see, anyone can get used to anything in time. Acclimatization, perhaps.
Warren Mitchell as Professor Krevet, explaining the weird goings-on to reporter Lawrence Payne. As the monsters descend the mountain under a veil of radioactive cloud, the villagers seek refuge in the professor's laboratory. With the creatures preferring freezing temperatures, they're finally destroyed in a firebomb attack. The fiery climax, the aliens, and the film's other special effects were created by industry veteran Les Bowie. Bowie never forgot his work on the Trollenberg Terror and winced every time he saw the shot of the cloud-shrouded mountain. Why? Well, the budget would only allow for a clump of cotton wool pinned to a travelogue photo. With all these extraterrestrial visitors, it's about time we returned the favour. Actually, filmmakers first entertained the idea of spaceflight in the early silent films of George Méliès. As the cinema grew more sophisticated, the heavens beckoned, and according to the scriptwriters of the 1950s, all you needed was a reliable spacesuit, some sophisticated-looking computers, a destination, and, oh yes, someone to build you a rocket ship.
Look, General, building rocket satellites is big stuff. I couldn't begin to finance one of those.
I'm not asking you to rebuild the satellite.
What in blazes are you driving at now?
The moon. The next rocket we build is going to the moon.
Let's go to lunch.
I'm serious, Jim.
No, you can't be. It's too fantastic. The moon? Impossible.
Well, what do you say, Jim? Do we go to lunch? Or do we go to the moon?
Sounds as if lunch would have been less expensive. That was Tom Powers trying to persuade John Archer to build him a spaceship in George Powell's first science fiction film, Destination Moon. It might seem difficult for us to understand why Archer was so skeptical, but until 1940, it was generally assumed that the only way to launch a projectile into space successfully was to fire it from an enormous gun, like the human cannonball act in the circus. When the Nazis, and ironically, the father of the NASA Apollo missions, Dr. Wernher von Braun, developed the V-2 rocket, the concept of space travel became a reality. Unlike most of Hollywood, George Powell was quick to realize the potential in science fiction films and almost single-handedly raised the necessary finance, some $500,000, to make the film. Powell was convinced that audiences would take Destination Moon seriously.
In 1950, when we made Destination Moon, I know I was very much annoyed when people came on the stage and they said, ah, you're making a fantasy. Because we didn't feel that we're making a fantasy at that time. We felt that we're making a documentary of the near future. We had put cracks on the moon, and we, knowing very well that there are no cracks on the moon, but we needed something that we can make a forced perspective. So we made the cracks very large in the foreground and very small in the background.
In order to recreate the lunar surface on a Hollywood soundstage, Powell enlisted the help of popular artist Chesley Bonestell, whose illustrations of the planets in our solar system had appeared in magazines such as Collier's and Life. A perfectionist, Bonestell drew everything in precise detail, even down to the type of spacesuit required for working on the surface of another planet or making vital repairs to the outside of a spaceship in flight. Their spaceship, nicknamed Luna, was a sleek silver rocket that was to become a blueprint for a number of later Hollywood spacecraft. Destination Moon even predated Stanley Kubrick's epic 2001 A Space Odyssey. With special effects still in their infancy, Powell's technicians built a control cabin for the Luna that could be swiveled in any direction to simulate weightlessness. The film, as science fiction author Ray Bradbury remembers, was a movie milestone.
Back in 1950, when we all trooped off to see Destination Moon, we expected to have the breath stunned out of us, and we did. We were so grateful for the fact that finally a color film had been made on a subject that we all love.
Hollywood soon learned to love science fiction when Destination Moon grossed over $5.5 million at the box office. It also won the Oscar for special effects and wide acclaim from other filmmakers, including director Robert Wise.
When I saw Destination Moon, it had a real, real impact on me. You know, it was so beautifully done. Matter of fact, I'm sure that this impact that it made on me had a lot to do with my thinking and working on the day the Earth stood still. Because Destination Moon was really a major turning point in film history.
Unlike the astronauts in Destination Moon, who returned safely to Earth, the three spacemen who blasted off in Professor Quatermass's rocket weren't so fortunate. After crash landing in a field on the outskirts of an English village, the only survivor, Victor Caroon, is diagnosed as suffering from a strange illness. The mystery deepens when no trace of his companions is found aboard the rocket. The airlock hadn't been opened since liftoff, and yet there are no bodies. So begins the first of Nigel Neal's science fiction stories, The Quatermass Experiment. Tries to solve the facts behind the missing astronauts. As the medical condition of Victor Caroon, magnificently played by actor Richard Wordsworth, deteriorates, the scientists make a terrifying discovery.
This growth on the face, half plant, half... Look at this. Look what it's done. The whole tissue structure's eaten away. The bone's powder.
Well, that takes care of my supper tonight.
Briscoe, what if there is a form of life in space?
It entered the rocket. It found living specimens of our form of life. If, even by accident, it could enter one of those structures, what a way to invade the Earth.
Good grief. You mean Caroon's
a carrier. He's now in the shell of a man being transformed, with the ability to destroy, and possess,
and multiply.
At will.
Having escaped from hospital, the tortured astronaut is hunted down amid the bomb sites of a post-war London. Locations in this Hammer film production are used to a most chilling effect. Finally, mutating into a monstrous mass of tendrils, Caroon is cornered in Westminster Abbey, his inhuman form suffocating everything in its path.
We don't know what it is.
How long before it starts reproducing again?
Based on the last cycle, 80 or 90 minutes, and then within the hours, for every one, there'll be a million.
It's coming lower.
We've got to stop it.
We need a miracle to stop it now.
It's barely pulsating now.
My timing was out. It's in its last dormant stage just before it reproduces.
It's changing again.
The beginning of new sculptures and sounds, doesn't it?
Why, it's hanging there, wrapped around the scaffolding.
Frisco, I think we can stop it.
And stop it he does in the nick of time with a large dose of electricity. A similar idea, you may recall, to the one used to eliminate the thing from another world. The film ends with the professor planning his second rocket launch. Nothing, it seems, was going to interfere with man's exploration of space.
This is a story of tomorrow, or the day after tomorrow, when men have built a station in space constructed in the form of a great wheel and set 1,000 miles out from the Earth, serving a double purpose, an observation post in the heavens and a place where a spaceship can be assembled and then launched to explore other planets and the vast universe itself in the last and greatest adventure of mankind, a plunge toward the conquest of space.
The conquest of space was another attempt by its producer, George Pal, to repeat the success of Destination Moon. As before, he turned for inspiration to the art of Chesley Bonestell and the expertise of Wernher von Braun. For Pal, remembers Star Trek producer Gene Roddenberry, it was to be another pioneering effort in science fiction entertainment.
Only in later years has George Pal's impact on science fiction and fantasy really begun to be realized. As you look at films ranging from the Star Trek television series to the Star Trek films, and of course Star Wars, Lucas's films, Spielberg's films, and all of the others, you see pieces of George Pal all through them, things that where he really broke the ground.
Sadly, however, Paramount Studios' insistence on script rewrites resulted in a very pedestrian adventure involving preparations for a trip to the moon that are suddenly cut short by new orders and a new destination.
Mars. George, it's fantastic. A long time ago, the Supreme Council issued an order that the final objective of this project was to be the planet Mars. You were present at all those discussions. The moon was never anything more than just a test hop. Now the orders are to eliminate the test and proceed with the original plan.
To gamble the lives of a crew of men on as senseless a mission as this is callous. Stupid.
Stupid or callous, it may seem to be at this time. It is not senseless. Man's very survival on Earth depends upon the success of this or some future search for a new source of raw materials.
When do we leave?
That was Walter Brook expressing his dismay at William Hopper's news. It's a pity that they just didn't rerun the moon trip, for the journey to Mars proves tedious for both the actors and the audience. The special effects by Oscar winner John P. Fulton, the man who helped God part the Red Sea for Cecil B. DeMille, are impressive enough. But this scientifically accurate voyage through our solar system was disappointing, to say the least. The red planet turns out to be a lifeless world, where the only drama is provided by an occasional Mars quake. Bypassing Mars seemed a very sensible idea, and was quite feasible with a large enough budget, say $2 million, which is precisely what Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer spent on Forbidden Planet, one of the brightest stars in the science fiction firmament.
In the final decade of the 21st century, men and women in rocket ships landed on the moon. By 2200 AD, they had reached the other planets of our solar system. Almost at once, there followed the discovery of Kuiper Drive, through which the speed of light was first attained and later greatly surpassed. And so at last, mankind began the conquest and colonization of deep space.
And it's in deep space that the cruiser C-57D finds the exotic world of Altair 4, a dusty planet with a pale green sky and two huge moons. Leslie Nielsen, now a successful comedy actor in films such as The Naked Gun, plays Commander J.J. Adams, who, together with his crew, is assigned to visit a far-flung planet in order to rescue members of a previous expedition. Approaching Altair 4, Adams is relieved to hear a human voice over the intercom.
Spaceship, identify yourself. You're being tracked.
Cut me in. United Planets cruiser C-57D, J.J. Adams commanding. Who are you?
Morbius of the Bellerophon. What do you wish here, cruiser?
Well, you don't understand, sir. We're your relief. We're very glad to find you alive.
I, of course, appreciate your concern, but absolutely no assistance of any sort is required.
Well, the red carpet treatment, huh?
Commander, if you step down on this planet, I warn you that I cannot be answerable for the safety of your ship or your crew.
If you didn't recognize the voice of Dr. Morbius, it belonged to Walter Pidgeon. Forbidden Planet, a film which greatly influenced the producers of Star Trek, was conceived by special effects expert and science fiction writer Irving Bloch. Bloch had been responsible for the energy thief Kronos, whom, you may remember, we discussed earlier in the program. He thought Forbidden Planet would make an interesting B-picture, but his agent persuaded him to take it to MGM. The rest is, as they say, history. For sheer scope, breathtaking visuals, and, thankfully, a witty and intelligent script, Forbidden Planet, like The War of the Worlds and The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, is now considered one of the best films of the genre. Even the special effects involving the model spaceship were, as technician A.D. Flowers recalls, planned down to the minutest detail.
We also, on Forbidden Planet, tried at one time to photograph the flying saucers with stop motion. As a matter of fact, we built quite an elaborate rig that would only move the saucer about 2 to 3 inches at a time and keep on going. And it worked out quite well, except that the way that we moved it, it was hanging off of wires, and it would take too long between shots for the swinging to stop. And so they finally threw that out to fly the flying saucers, and all of that, we went back to the old ways of flying them on piano wire.
You just can't beat the tried and trusted methods. But piano wire and miniatures weren't necessary to create Forbidden Planet's most fondly remembered character, Robbie the Robot. An icon of cinema science fiction, Robbie's domed head with its pulsating lights, his humanoid appearance, and his total obedience made him a star.
Welcome to Altair 4, gentlemen. I am to transport you to the residence.
This is no offense, but you are a robot, aren't you?
That is correct, sir. For your convenience, I am monitored to respond to the name Robbie.
Film historian and expert on Forbidden Planet, Bill Malone.
One of the biggest problems in building Robbie really was keeping the weight down and so forth. And they came up with a very high-tech answer to this. Originally, he was to be made out of wood. And what they did was they designed instead a body made out of vacuum-form plastic. He's made out of a material called Royalite, which is ABS. Royalite was a material used to make primarily luggage. Well, Robbie weighed almost 110 pounds, and in order to support that weight, the operator actually had to carry the weight around. In other words, the legs do not support the robot. The actor inside actually carried the weight on his shoulder, which meant that the guy could only stay inside for maybe 20 minutes at a time before they had to put him in a rack that they had, which was a sort of metal shelving thing that he sort of backed into.
Robbie transports Adams and two of the crew to Dr. Morbius's desert home, where they meet his beautiful daughter, Altera, played by Anne Francis. Morbius tells them of the Krell, a fantastic civilization that had existed on the planet many thousands of years before. Morbius then shows them some of the Krell's technical wonders. But the question of what happened to the Doctor's colleagues, the other members of the Bellerophon expedition, still remain unanswered.
One by one, in spite of every safeguard, my co-workers were torn literally limb from limb.
By what?
By some devilish thing that never once showed itself.
And the Bellerophon?
Vaporized as the three remaining survivors tried to take her off.
And yet, in all these 19 years, you personally have never again been bothered by this planetary force.
Only in nightmares of those times. And yet, always in my mind, I seem to feel the creature is lurking somewhere close at hand, sly and irresistible, and only waiting to be re-invoked for murder.
And murder it does, as one by one, members of Adam's crew are slaughtered by the invisible beast. After a fierce battle, the creature is stopped, but even the ship's high-powered artillery batteries fail to kill it.
Doc, an invisible being that cannot be disintegrated by atomic fission.
Our skipper,
That is a scientific impossibility. But any organism dense enough to survive 3 billion electron volts would have to be made of solid nuclear material. It'd sink of its own weight to the center of this planet.
Well, you saw it yourself, standing right there in those neutron beams.
And there's your answer. It must have been renewing its molecular structure from one microsecond to the next. Now, if you remember the Bellerophon expedition, the ship was vaporized trying to lift off.
Adams finally discovers that the Krell prematurely destroyed themselves when a scientific experiment went tragically wrong. Constructing a machine to propel thought waves, the aliens had unwittingly released the demons of their subconscious, the monsters from the id. By tampering with the Krell machinery, Morbius has unleashed his own monster and is powerless to stop it. Created by Disney special effects animator Joshua Meador, it's said that the huge head and massive jaws of the creature were patterned on MGM's famous Leo the Lion. The heart-pounding climax as the monster stalks Altera, Adams and its creator, makes for one of the most exciting sequences ever filmed. Another fascinating aspect of Forbidden Planet is that Block deliberately based his script on Shakespeare's The Tempest. No, it's true. Prospero's enchanted island becomes the alien planet, Altair 4. Prospero is Dr. Morbius. Miranda is his daughter, Altera. Caliban doubles as the invisible murderer, and the play's famous spirit, Ariel, is Robbie the Robot. The studio avoided commenting on this highbrow connection, fearful that it might turn audiences away. They needn't have worried. A huge box office success, Forbidden Planet truly deserves the title of classic. A section of the unique electronic score from Forbidden Planet by Louis and B.B. Baron. Like the special effects, music and sound play an important part in science fiction films. Whether it's the sound of a heat ray, a spaceship blasting off, or the interior of a flying saucer. But creating sounds which are out of this world isn't easy. For example, how would an Interocitor sound? Or an approaching Zargon spaceship? Both appeared in This Island Earth, a film that won an industry award for Universal's sound department. In the story, scientist Cal Meacham, played by Rex Reason, receives a mysterious electronics catalogue which shows him how to build an Interocitor. Once constructed, this unusual machine brings a communique from a man with a remarkably high forehead called Exeter, played by Jeff Morrow. Together with a team of scientists, including Ruth Adams, played by Faith Domergue, Meacham is employed by Exeter to develop new forms of nuclear power. When the scientists realize that their new boss is an alien, they try to escape, but are captured and taken aboard his flying saucer.
Sorry that our visit below had to be terminated so dramatically, but time allowed for nothing else. I can assure you we mean you no harm. Look, the two of you are beginning a strange journey, a journey that no Earth people have ever undertaken before. Now, whether you consider me a devil or a saint is unimportant. What is important is that you're here on this spaceship.
Where are we going?
To a planet we call Metaluna.
Metaluna? There's no such planet in the solar system.
Metaluna lies far beyond your solar system, in outer space.
Exeter's home planet, Metaluna, has for centuries been engaged in a terrible interplanetary war with its neighbor, Zargon. With nuclear resources almost exhausted, he needs the Earth's help to repair the planet's protective force field. As Exeter's ship approaches his doomed world, he shows the terrible effects of the war to his captives.
What you're observing may well be the beginning of the end for our world. The Zargon meteors are beginning to get through our ionized layer. That haze, a field of intense radiation. As you can well imagine, such a screen requires the output of great amounts of atomic energy.
And you're running out. That's why you were sent to Earth.
And why you sent for us. You need uranium.
In gigantic quantities. Our own deposits are exhausted. As our power diminishes, our protection fails.
The leader of the Metalunans isn't as benevolent as Exeter, and once again, Meacham and Adams make good an escape, while Metaluna roasts under the onslaught of the Zargon missile attack. The strange landscape of Metaluna, with its pockmarked surface, scarred by explosions, was created from drawings by Disney animator Frans van Lamswerder. The special effects in glorious Technicolor by David Hawley and Clifford Stein are quite spectacular, especially when accompanied by the film's exotic sound effects. But the film's best-remembered character is its bug-eyed monster, the Metaluna Mutant. Standing some 7 feet in height, it had grotesque, skull-like features with an oversized cranium, giant pincers for hands, and a body covered in thick, pulsating veins. Inspired by unused drawings of the aliens from It Came From Outer Space, the Mutant was created by Hollywood veteran Bud Westmore's makeup department. This Island Earth was directed by Joseph Newman, and according to some reports, our old friend Jack Arnold. It attempted to warn mankind of the futility of war, as had The Day the Earth Stood Still. And at the film's conclusion, Exeter sacrifices himself to ensure that Meacham and Adams reach Earth safely. However, Home Sweet Home might not have seemed so welcoming if it had been the same planet Earth that's featured in our last film tonight, George Powell's When Worlds Collide.
Zyra is about the same size as our Earth. Both these bodies are coming into our solar system.
How far away from us are they?
As I would estimate, about 3 billion miles. But they could be upon us in less than 1 year. The planet Zyra will pass very close to us. Close enough to influence the tides. Oceans will be torn from their depths. Tidal waves hundreds of feet high will sweep in from the coasts. There will be giant earthquakes. Handfuls of people may survive if provisions are made.
We'll make them. Every possible effort. Whatever help my factories can give, we will give gladly.
It will be useless. Soon after, Belus will come into direct collision with the Earth. Our world will end.
The effect of Zara's passing is just how Dr. Hendren, played by Larry Keating, predicted. Thousands are killed in the cataclysmic earthquakes, erupting volcanoes, and landslides. Hurricanes wreak havoc, and in one awesome scene, New York is swamped by massive tidal waves. Needless to say, the film won Powell another Oscar for its special effects. The only hope for survival was to escape by rocket to Zara, an Earth-type planet, according to the astronomers. As the giant sun, Belus, looms ever closer, the ship, like some modern Noah's Ark, is stocked with provisions, animals, and a wealth of man's cultural and literary achievements. As the Earth is vaporized, the ship lands safely on Zara, and a new life awaits its passengers in the fantastic world of science fiction Hollywood style. It was to be some years after Professor Quatermass that the Russian cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin became the first man in space, and considerably longer before American astronauts landed on the moon. It may well be into the next century before man visits other worlds. But until then, the events depicted in films such as Destination Moon, Forbidden Planet, When Worlds Collide, and all the other fantastic adventures we've shared tonight will continue to reflect the aspirations, hopes, and dreams of the people who see them. Keep Watching the Skies was written and researched by Richard Hollis. The producer was Barry Littlechild. Thank you for joining me, Joanna Lumley, on a voyage through outer space. And until next time, I'll leave you with Leith Stevens' score for the climax of When Worlds Collide.